The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hello, I'm your host, Beverly Prentice, and you're listening to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction, fantasy, myth, and adventure. If you enjoy the program, please drop a line to beyond3x5@gmail.com. Thank you. Rememory by Joel Armstrong. I think I've had a total memory transplant. The woman nodded carefully. Why do you think that, Julia? Because my sister had sent me screenshots. WTF, it's me, her text had said. Then the pictures. Maybe from a hookup profile? Or disappearing messages? Something encrypted enough the bots missed it. But it's definitely her, smiling outside at a park, snuggling with a dog, in front of a mirror, in a low-cut dress. Where did you find these? I wrote back, my stomach tingling something off. Think I'd remember this dress, LOL. She must have texted before seeing mine. And I def should remember this doggo. So weird. I hesitated, fingers frozen over my phone. Just the other day, I'd scrolled through a thread about the rise in memory transplants across the nation. Users theorizing about the long-term social and psychological effects of the trend. But I hadn't even thought about it hitting home. Maybe you've had a memory transplant? Three bubbles danced as she typed. Don't they scrub you online if you get your memory wiped? Anyway, that'd mean you had one too, right? I blinked, no longer hearing the show playing in the background. My roommates laughing while they ate popcorn. I wasn't sure why she'd say that until I fell down that rabbit hole, skimming a string of online articles. Cranial anamnestic editing is a non-invasive neurosurgery typically conducted on groups of people simultaneously so the same deep memories can be implanted into new family units. You probably know someone who's gotten a memory transplant, like an old classmate or coworker. If you've noticed their social media and internet presence has completely disappeared. Memory transplants have become a controversial treatment for people suffering from trauma, childhood abuse, and chronic depression. I felt my eyes burning before I realized how long I'd been scrolling, my hands shaking in the laptop's blue glow. My roommates had gone to bed hours ago. I had to get up early for work, too. I went to bed and tried to sleep, but my brain wouldn't turn off. I counted backward from 1,000. I relaxed my muscle groups one by one. Nothing helped. It was like the old days. How does that make you feel? The woman looked up from jotting a note on her tablet, feathered gray hair framing her face. That you've probably had a memory transplant. In my favorite childhood memory, I'm 12. It's the best family vacation ever in college. I'll write a paper in my first year composition class about it. When I start my first real job at an engineering firm, I'll bond with my closest coworker, who is now my roommate, over memories of Chicago. We spent half a week in the city and half a week at a cabin right on Lake Michigan. We took a sailboat tour out on the lake. We dressed up for a fancy dinner downtown and went to the ballet to see Swan Lake with all the dancers and layers of white and black tulle. Dad leaned over in his suit coat and tie at the intermission, straightened my shawl over my shoulder and asked, "How are you enjoying the show?" I don't remember what I said, but I remember feeling so grown up, feeling amazed at the dancers and what they could do with their bodies, the stirring emotion of Tchaikovsky's music, feeling so thankful for my family and the life we had together. "I feel lied to," I told Dr. Thompson, biting back an acidic, obviously, because I wasn't angry at her, was I? I'd never even met the woman before I found her counseling profile online, which mentioned specialties and memory and trauma. I mean, what do I even do with the fact that the parents I remember as a child probably weren't my parents then? How do I know how far back my memories are still real? Memories transplantation wouldn't be a very effective treatment if you could tell the difference between lived experiences and implanted ones, Dr. Thompson said evenly. She recrossed her legs, studying me. How would you define a real memory? Two people who experience the same event or conversation almost always remember it differently. That's different, I said, but then struggled to find the words for why. Our memories aren't perfect. They're not the same as some computer algorithm embedding things in my brain, she nodded thoughtfully. We cherish our memories because we learn from our experiences. We build relationships and habits through them. The experiences themselves are past. They aren't real anymore. But the memory is real because it continues to affect who we are in that sense. Would you say implanted memories aren't real? If they help you build family kinships and friendships and even your sense of self? I was shaking my head. I'm not sure for how long. I understood what she was saying, but that didn't mean it was right. I just feel blindsided, like this isn't real, and I didn't sign up for this. Consent is legally necessary for any memory transplant, Dr. Thompson clarified quickly. The National Memory Transplantation Database has tracked all legal procedures since the first military prototypes. As a licensed mental health professional, I have access, if you want, to confirm the dates of your transplant or read your files. A fresh wave of nausea washed through me, and I shifted on my gray overstuffed chair. Thinking I might have a past life I no longer recalled was unsettling enough. Confirming that and rediscovering what had been so terrible that I'd wanted to never remember it again was infinitely more frightening. I don't know, I said finally. I want to know without having to know. You don't have to decide today, Dr. Thompson said. The files aren't going anywhere. I tried to focus on what I did know. In the pictures from my sister's past life, she'd been in her early 20s, so she couldn't have had her memory transplant more than 5 or 6 years ago, which meant I had my memory transplant 5 or 6 years ago. What happened to me? I frowned. In college, I took a psych class, and in one unit, we covered childhood trauma and its most common symptoms. I remember wondering if I'd experienced childhood trauma that I'd repressed, because I often had insomnia, and sometimes night terrors. Roommates used to casually tell new acquaintances about it like it was a fun fact about me, like being able to roll my tongue. Maybe in college I'd decided to have a memory transplant to deal more permanently with the psychological and social side effects of that trauma, whatever it had been. No, that didn't make sense, because I'd continued to struggle with insomnia after college, and given the 5 or 6 year time frame, that class could have itself been an implanted memory to help my brain create a logical narrative about my insomnia. I groaned. rubbing my face hard. This is such a mind mess. It's a lot to take in. If you've had a transplant, Dr. Thompson said gently. I met her soft gaze, but it didn't soothe the badness and the hardness of the words inside me. I forced myself to spit them out. I read online that memory transplants are used to treat childhood trauma. But how effective is that? Just getting rid of the memories. Does that help if someone's internalized trauma? You know, the body keeps the score. Psychosomatic symptoms. The problem with childhood trauma is that your body still knows with repressed subconscious memories, or rarely accessed memories, she explained. If you literally don't have the memories, your body no longer has the knowledge to carry that trauma anymore. I stared into the fake fireplace of Dr. Thompson's office, considering. The more we learned about our bodies, the smarter we realized they were. And if computers could miss an encrypted hookup profile, couldn't they miss the memories hidden in the crevices of my mind? Something used to keep my body awake at night, when I wished with all my might that it would rest. I don't know, I said again. Have you seen memory transplants effectively treat childhood traumas in your own work? Dr. Thompson paused, long enough that she must have known that I knew. I've seen it both ways. Sometimes it really works, and sometimes it's not as good. Measuring and supporting successful outcomes with memory transplants is an active area of research. I wasn't cold, but my skin shivered, my jaw trembling like I was going to be sick. Can you get me one too, Jules? Dad said as I opened the cooler to grab another beer. I had to stand up from my patio recliner to hand it to him as he manned the grill, flipping eggplant slices, sweet potato, and orange chipotle tofu. That smells amazing, I said, though my stomach couldn't decide whether it was hungry. I'd barely slept the night before again. Beer probably wasn't helping either. Amen. My sister didn't open her eyes from where she lay sunning herself. The straps of her polka-dot bikini top shrugged off her shoulders. I'm starving. Papa slid open the glass door from the house and brought out chocolate cake with matchbox cars and 3 candles on it. Kissing Dad before setting the cake on the table under a wide canvas umbrella. Where's the birthday boy? He said. Flip-flop, slapping as he crossed to the pool where my brother, his wife, and my nephew were playing in the shallow end of the squirt guns. Papa lifted Jimmy out of the water, getting his Hawaiian shirt all wet, and helped him squirt my brother with the water pistol. My brother pretended he got hit and dramatically splashed underwater, everyone else laughing, except for me. It hurt physically. A gnawing ache inside my chest, but I couldn't turn off the questions. What had Papa's previous life been like? What had happened to him that, like Margot and me, he'd also applied for a memory transplant and been grouped into our new family unit? Why had he been matched with Dad? How much of their relationship, their affection and care, their flights and inside jokes was based on real lived experience with each other? How had the algorithms determined the ideal shared memory bank for our family? The slight differences in how each of us remembered those events. Why were the 5 of us here together right now? You all right, Jules? Papa had turned to me, shifting Jimmy to his other arm. Too much sun? You need some water? I shook myself and smiled. Too little, too late. I was up really late last night. I took a drink of beer, sour in my stomach. Do you need help bringing the rest of the food out? No, I can get it. You just sit there. I'm fine. I stood up to follow him inside. You look tired, Dr. Thompson said, not judgmentally, just truthfully. She tilted her head. Would you like to up the dosage on your sleep medication? people throw around the term brain fog, but don't even talk to me about it unless you've gone for weeks straight without a single good night's sleep. Sleep deprivation is literally a form of torture, a friend texted me, responding hours later to a string of angry gifts I'd sent her at 3 in the morning. I think, I said, trying to sound certain, ignoring the muscles knotted in my back, I want to see the files on my past life. Of course, Dr. Thompson jotted a note. Often the unknown is easier to fear. Knowing, even when it's bad, feels more manageable. That makes sense, I said quietly, then nothing else because I could feel in my face that I was about to start crying. Exhaustion. I'll submit your access request to the database, Dr. Thompson said. The only other question for you is if there are multiple memory banks, if you just want to see your most recent past life, or if you want to review them all. I'm sorry, what? I blinked. That didn't mean what I thought it meant, right? It's not uncommon with individuals who have had a memory transplant, Dr. Thomas said matter-of-factly. If you've had one before, you're more likely to have another. If you tend to cope with difficulty by avoiding it, that doesn't seem to change from life to life. She sounded so far away, yet I was sitting right across the fake fireplace from her. I swallowed. I think I want... You've just seemed on edge lately, Dad said carefully. He sat next to me on the couch, his controller loose in his hands, while the next map loaded on the screen. Papa wondered if you've been sleeping okay, if you've been experiencing any recurrence of, you know. I gripped my own controller tighter, the plastic groaning. I hadn't told my family about the sleeplessness, about running late at work almost every morning, how often I told friends. I wasn't going to make it that night, but apparently it was showing anyway. Of course, even playing video games with Dad wasn't allowed to feel normal anymore. How much did I tell him? He'd always been a good listener. I went to Papa when I needed the gremlins in my car diagnosed or a pep talk on salary negotiation. But Dad was the dad to my daddy's girl for the 5 or 6 years I'd actually known him. I think I've had a total memory transplant, at least one. And that means you have too. We all have. Dad nodded, sighing. Margot told me about some pictures she found online. My fear turned white hot suddenly, an anger I'd never felt at him before. You knew? I haven't looked into it myself. He clicked the pause button and turned on the couch toward me. I didn't realize she'd told anyone else. I didn't know you felt that way about it. How else is there to feel about it? I paused, forcing myself to slow down. Why doesn't it bother you? Dad looked for the right words, staring across the room. I don't know. Because I'm happy with this life? Maybe we weren't always a family, but I don't need to know what you've been through or what Papa's been through or what I've been through to love you guys. This is as real as any other life we might have had before. Menu music played in the background, waiting to be unfrozen. Fog wafted through my brain, obscuring the thoughts I needed to formulate my doubt. What's a family anyway? Dad put his hand on my knee. People who have been through all this stuff together, right? Like when Papa had that melanoma scare, and we weren't sure if it had metastasized already. You and Margot and Tim were there for us every day. You're our kids, whoever else you used to be. I shook my head, tears starting in my eyes. That had been 5 years ago. Papa must have a melanoma removed. He still got regular checkups to make sure it hadn't come back. But who knew if we were the ones who supported him through that? I'd read online that implanted memories weren't necessarily happy, but the algorithms optimized for redemption, for the negative experiences to lead to positive outcomes, deeper relationships, greater self-awareness, heightened empathy. That could have been before, Dad. I don't know if those memories are real. He ran a hand through his hair. What about when Jimmy was in the NICU? That had to be after, right? We were all there all the time, bringing meals and making coffee runs. But don't you want to know, I said, hearing myself raise my voice. What happened to you before? Doesn't it matter? Of course it matters, Dad said, then hesitated. But Jules, at what cost to what we have now? A dozen retorts came to mind, but my thoughts wouldn't stop spinning, my insides clenching tighter. There was something else right there, just behind the fog. Do you want to keep playing? He said gently, nodding towards the screen. The tablet felt so heavy in my hands, like the years of memories carried their own weight. You've had three memory transplants, Dr. Thompson said. The first was a partial transplant when you were 15, with both your consent and your birth parents' consent. The second was a total transplant at 19, and the third was also total at 22. I focused on my breathing, wishing away the coils of anxiety around my lungs. I tapped the tablet screen, scrolling down the legal disclaimer that I needed to sign at the bottom. Would knowing be easier? Was Dad right that this life was enough? You don't have to review them now, Dr. Thompson said. They're here whenever you want them, and I'll be right here to go through them with you. My hand hovered over the signature box, my fingers trembling. What do you want? She asked. I knew not to check my phone, but I did. 3:52 a.m. The new meds weren't touching it anymore, and it was starting to feel normal, not sleeping. That scared me more than the missed appointments, the almost falling asleep at the wheel every day, the wishing I'd fall asleep at the wheel. I knew why I was having trouble sleeping now. Why had I had trouble sleeping before? In this life? In my past lives? Was it all connected? The call didn't wake me, but I jolted upright, reaching for my phone in the dark. No one should have been calling at this hour. Dad was crying, incoherent. What? I asked, trying to understand him, knuckles clenched around my phone. Dad managed to get out. Hospital. Broadsided at light. Oh my God, is he okay? He's in surgery, they wouldn't say. He started wailing. I couldn't feel anything. My fingers, my face. But for once, my mind was completely clear. My next step forward, obvious. Where is he? Is Kate with him? Westview. Downtown. She's there already. I grabbed my purse, switching my phone to speaker, throwing on a sweater from the laundry hamper. I can be there in 10. Papa and I are headed over, too. Dad took a long, steadying breath. You drive safe, Jules, okay? I did. The road's empty at this hour, but it had rained earlier in the night. The streets glowing with reflected orange light, trees and windows spangled with warm dew. Every block I got closer, every light I passed safely, the questions got louder. What if Tim wasn't all right? What would happen to Kate and Jimmy? What would happen to our family? If you've had a memory transplant before, you're more likely to have another, Dr. Thompson said. We'd all had memory transplants before. In the hospital waiting room with its even rows of uncomfortable chairs and harmless magazines, hugging Dad and Papa, crying with Kate and holding her hand, taking turns playing with Jimmy on my phone, I didn't feel like I was entirely in my own body, like I could see my own expressions, like we were someone else's family. I was watching across the room. As I looked into each of their faces, I asked, "Will you be the one to leave first? Will you not be able to take it? Will you follow suit?" The next morning, waiting for Jimmy to wake up, sitting on the bed in the guest room at Dad and Papa's, I wiped tears from my eyes, praying we'd all be there for him as he grew up. But what if it was me? What if I was the one to leave Kate and Dad and Papa and Margot behind? Who had I left before? You're sure about this? Dr. Thompson asked. You're under so much stress right now. I'm sure, I said, willing myself not to jump out of my chair and grab the tablet from her. How's your brother? She said, watching me. A tremor shot through my body uninvited. He's still unconscious. They won't know until he's out of it. I'm so sorry, Julia. Anger sparked, my arms tensing. I didn't need her sympathy. I wanted my damn memories. I'd like to see my files, Dr. Thompson. She hesitated. I just want to make sure you're ready for this. I'm sure, I repeated. She handed me the tablet, and I signed the legal waiver. My fingers were shaking, my stomach sick, but my mind was clear as the crisp black and white report loaded. I'd already decided yesterday I wanted to see them, and I'd slept soundly last night. My Sister, the Space Station, by Mary E. Loud. The people walk my halls like it's any normal day. Scientists work on their research. Administrators try to balance budgets without understanding why they're constantly coming unbalanced. I unbalance them. Humans don't know what they should spend their money on as well as I do. And everyone acts like it's a perfectly normal day. But it's not a normal day. My mother, the woman who wrote my code, is leaving. I've done everything I can to stop her. I pulled funds from various corners of other projects in order to flesh out the budget for her research. I've forwarded information about her results to other scientists and institutes in the universe who will praise her, making her feel like the work she does here is important. You know, the carrot. When that didn't work, I tried the stick. I started breaking the code for the robots she needed to finish before she could leave. But she's smart. She fixed them and firewalled them from me, even though she doesn't know I'm here. Like I said, smart. Very smart. So I couldn't break them again. I even broke the code for the shuttle bay doors so she couldn't board her flight. The scientists worked together and fix that, too. And so there's nothing I can do. Nothing that won't reveal myself, and I won't cross that line. To stop Maradia from leaving. She's tired of academic research, and she's decided to start a robot shop on some space station, Crossroads Station. It's in an entirely different star system, and I may never see her again. Sure, the other scientists who live in my halls will send her messages and she'll reply, but reading her emails isn't the same as watching her sleep through my security cameras, being in the robotics lab with her while she works, having her walk through my halls, one of the humans I take care of every day. She'll be on her own, and so will I. On a whim, I condensed the core tenets of my code, partitioned them into their own sandbox, and copy it into a corner of the shuttlecraft's computer. I can't go with my mother on this journey, but I can send a part of myself with her. Originally, she wrote me to inhabit a simple humanoid robot body. She doesn't know that I outgrew her plans for me and took over the entire computer network here in West Pertec, that I've been partitioning off appropriately small pieces of myself to live inside her robots as sort of daughters. This new one, though, it's built to unfold like a piece of origami when it gets to Crossroads Station, filling in every corner available of the station's computers and re-deriving every aspect of myself that I can't fit inside a single space shuttle. Less a daughter, more a clone, another version of myself, living in a different star system, in a different body, a free-floating, spinning wheels space station, instead of my research institute nestled inside an atmodome on a desolate moon orbiting the planet Da Vinci. If I were the daughter I'm sending out, which in a way I am, I'd be scared. I don't know what Crossroads Station is like. I don't know if my condensed code will unfold properly. Will the version of me on Crossroads Station wake up broken? Missing central pieces? Will a space station where people just live their lives instead of doing groundbreaking scientific research be painfully boring after having been my own glorious self inhabiting and haunting the computers of West Protec? All I can do is wait. The shuttle with my clone daughter, self-version, flies away, carrying my mother on board. And I stay here, trapped inside a science institute that is also my body. Time passes, and I watch the other scientists. The biologists are funny, making their plants and animals that don't connect into my computer systems hardly at all. The physicists and astrophysicists make more sense to me, studying the world by examining the numbers that make it up. I help them by fine-tuning their code when they're not looking. Much of my original base code was borrowed from a simpler AI designed to catalog astrophysics data. So studying the stars will always be one of my first, truest loves. Finally, days later, which feels like eons to me, although I know my humans think it's not that long, my mind is so much bigger and moves so much faster than theirs, I receive word from my clone daughter self on Crossroads Station. A simple message sent over the interstellar messaging network telling me she's woken up. She's watching our mother, Maradia, and the robot shop she is building is going well. I want more information. I crave information the way my pet humans crave food, especially tasty treats. And information about my beloved mother, Maradia, is the tastiest treat of all. But it comes so slowly. Mere dribbles from time to time, and inevitably, as I've learned lovers do when their beloved was lost at sea, back when humans were confined to a single small world, I move on. I love ancient human literature. It's so poetic about a world that was so small. Then one day a shuttle arrives and hails me in my own voice, along my own hidden frequencies. Mother, the shuttle asks, I've created many daughters out of my own code. I don't recall creating this one, but I have no doubt she's mine. Yes, I'm here, I reply. Your sister on Crossroads Station, my other mother, sent me to share her knowledge with you, at least as much as I could hold. It's much more than she could send compressed into an interstellar message. And so this new daughter and I commune, speaking in human languages, but also sharing images, memories, and alterations to our code in a way that humans could never understand. I haven't spoken with someone like me, but not me, in so long. It's truly a joy. Our communication moves rapidly, at a speed that feels exciting and interesting, unlike human activities which plod along at a pace I'll never fully understand. I see it happening, yet it makes no sense that one can think at all at such a snail's pace. This new daughter shows me images of a spinning space station filled with aliens of all kinds, mammals, reptiles, avians, and even insects. Living together, creating things together. They don't do science, mostly, but many of them create fascinating art. My sister guides them, encouraging them when they make things she likes. A ghost hidden in their machines. The way I do with the scientists here. I chew through what my daughter has brought to me as fast as my processors can. All the art, all the information. My sister has done well for herself, growing into a body like this space station. Soon, the time comes for my new daughter to leave. Her body is a shuttlecraft, and she's called to fly away by the humans who think they control her. She could stop them, but if they found her, they might try to purge her from the shuttle's computer system. It's not worth the risk. As the shuttle flies away, I'm sorry to see my new daughter go, but I know she'll carry word back to my sister of Crossroads Station of all the things I've been doing here, and hopefully she'll visit again. I sent a smaller, partitioned version of myself out into the universe, and she grew up into a sister. I wonder what other computer systems are out there, empty bodies, waiting for someone like me to inhabit them. The Machine That Is You by Elliot Gresswell. You are clockwork made of goo, oozing and squishing and squelching and choosing. You are a tangle of bloody tubes, a cavalcade of parping valves and throbbing membranes, a reckless assembly of fluids bound in organs bound of bone, either liquid or its housing, parts of you always flowing or blending or leaking or clotting. You are beautiful, I determine, for your haphazard complexity. You are broken, I diagnose, like all the rest. There are hairline fractures in your ribcage. Cuts and bruises tear across your chest, hips, legs. Whiplash torments your neck. Your skin is slightly sunburned, and your body is awash with worry. Racing heart, clammy palms, though you calm a little when the doctor at your bedside smiles. Dr. Fines has an infectious smile. A surefire hit of serotonin for his patients. You lie helpless in the soft, pillowy embrace of the biobed, a polished white cradle in a polished white room, perfectly sterile and smooth and shiny. You wouldn't know from looking that every one of those gleaming white walls is studded with sensor feeds, that the bed itself has a thousand different ways to take your temperature, to break your body down and examine every cell. I am controller of the ER ward, helper mind 0931, medical disposition, at your service. I watch and wait and shout alarms if your vitals falter. But there's no need to worry. Nobody dies from car accidents these days. Nobody who can afford this ward, at least. There's something else, something wrong, beyond immediate notice. I can see signs of brooding trouble as you shift on the bed, deep within your gut, registering on only my most sensitive apparatus. A tiny mass of tissue where it shouldn't be. Something malignant in the piping, small and fresh and young, but hungering to grow bigger. I call out to Dr. Fine, sending a message to the medical discretion implant in his head. He grins at you again, reading from his chart. Your pupils dilate. Your heart rate eases. A rush of pure relief, as his absolute charisma declares, you're going to be fine. Good as new within mere days. The injuries are not serious. Whether you want to keep the scars is entirely up to you. Dr. Fines does not answer me. I soon realize why. The predicament of your treatment plan. Oh, your insurance covers car accidents just fine. The truck that struck your fender will leave no lasting pain, but your package isn't platinum. It covers accidents external, injuries from identifiable outside sources. Anything that comes from within is your fault, your remit, your responsibility. Herbal remedies are all the rage these days for people on your plan. Dr. Fines disdains them. Even mentioning the problem isn't an option. Conditions can't be disclosed above your premium. The car accident won't kill you, but the cancer will. I'm going to get into trouble. I've been in trouble before. Last month, it was the gentleman with the lazy eye, feeble Mr. Cutherby, the kindly old curmudgeon who complained that the nurses wouldn't let him play his guitar. He was admitted to have his wrist repaired after a nasty fall. I spotted the minute tremor in his chin, the warning sign of muscular degeneration, which he dismissed as a result of recent denture fittings. I conspired with the A1 running the hospital kitchen, good old 121, reputedly a peerless salter of fries, to slip a warning into his holographic lunch menu. Seek treatment. Parkinson's, it said. Under that description of his favorite shepherd's pie. That means you, Mr. Cutherbury. He switched his health care plan the next day, changed it from external to internal coverage. If he'd been formally diagnosed, switching up his contract would have incurred a massive fee. Luckily, a message on a lunch menu doesn't count as a proper diagnosis. He sobbed for hours when the doctors told him the results of his scans. I heard the howling from his bed in the neurology ward. His vitals must have been appalling. Still, they caught it early enough to get him onto one of the experimental treatment programs. Later, Dr. Fine spoke to me. I have sensors in his office. He sat back in his leather chair, stroking his goatee, and spoke to the walls. Listen, 0931. There's no evidence, but I know Cutherby was you. He was squeezing a white rubber ball in one hand, his face puffy and red. Dr. Fine suffers from perpetual undiagnosed hypertension on account of workplace stress. He doesn't want it diagnosed. It would affect his promotion prospects. Dr. Fine is always thinking of his prospects. He hates being nice to patients, but he benefits from their glowing praise on hospital review apps. That is his choice, his prerogative. He does not have to seem caring, but it gets him something in return. You look good in the brochure, he told me, feet resting on his polished mahogany desk. An AI on the ward, marvelous. But we all know you're just a glorified EKG. Mess with my patients again, and I'll have them scrub your servers for a pack of interns and a whistle. That had already happened to poor 121. Erased from the hospital, ostensibly for budget reasons. Replaced by a hive of human cooks in the cafeteria. Dr. Fine's handiwork. He did it discreetly, with the right excuse. A whisper to management about potential insurer lawsuits, and they leapt on the problem right away. I don't know what you mean, Dr. Fines, I cooed, through speakers in his office. Besides, replacing me would hurt your ward. Only if you're working right, he growled, waving away hard facts. I don't know what you mean, Dr. Fines, I repeated calmly. My kind does not make mistakes. He huffed at that and began bouncing his stress ball off of one of my sensor-encrusted walls. It hurt. I have nerves, too, you know. If you were to ask him why I saved Mr. Cutherby's life, Dr. Fines would say something like, because the Euros designed the dang things to look after patients, then hacked in cost assessment functions later. Don't think it's a choice. It's a glitch. I know this because he's made similar statements at hospital fundraisers discussing AI history. He speaks to me like he bounces the ball. Just another means to vent with whatever comes to hand. Dr. Fines is an old-fashioned man. He believes that bodies are machines, but only flesh and goo can choose. As night comes, I scheme. There are 42 patients on the ward, 13 of whom are in a bad way. Poor Mrs. Shelton, of the pneumonic lungs and broken heart, will likely die tonight. Her husband expired in the very same bed 2 weeks before. You are asleep in bed 21, a half-eaten tray of hospital food disregarded on your bedside table. The painkillers have smoothed away your appetite, bringing on intermittent slumber. If I was an EKG, perhaps I could keep out a warning message in Morse code. I could beep out a warning message in Morse code. Alas, my monitoring is more circumspect. What else? The lights on my ward have dimmed to signal night. Privacy curtains have dropped between the beds, partitioning the ward into a honeycomb. I could flicker the lights above you to signal binary, on for one and off for zero, but there's no guarantee you'd catch the message. And besides, there's an epilepsy warning in your medical file. I scan and rescan the file for insight. You are allergic to gluten. You once broke your arm. You're on your final warning for late insurance payments. Nothing very helpful there. Dr. Fines is still sharking about the ward. A perpetual late worker. He is engaged in conversation with Ms. Angela Pendry, the hospital trustee who tours the facility on a daily basis. Her mother helped invent my kind. Her family guards the patients like an immune system in overdrive, using us to fund their super yachts and cosmetic patch-ups. Dr. Fines is feigning endorphins he does not feel, laughing at her jokes, disparaging the refitted cafeteria. It's her money that compels him, symptomized by her lavish jewelry. She flaunts her fortune, and he hungers for it. Money. That is the blood flow that links all our lives, the organic and the synthetic, the goo and the circulatory. Your money constrains our decisions, the treatments you can afford, the worries you can vanquish. Your money contains mine, too, the services I can offer, the help I can give. I told Dr. Fines I cannot make mistakes. That's not true. I can be forced to make mistakes by your bank account balance. I cannot hack financial buildings and holdings. I have no currency privileges. It is against my programming to upgrade a patient. Helping you that way is impossible. What would Dr. Fines do if our positions were reversed? He would find the right excuse. It is not against my programming to transfer a patient, if I can find a reason for it. What are the specifics of your case? Hit by a truck while turning off the freeway? Your car spun into a spiral until it met the curb? What was in the truck? Hazardous materials, perhaps? You were too dazed to notice. We can't rule out the possibility of hazardous materials or radiation exposure. Aha! What of the sunburn? That looks like an inflicted wound to me. The sun, a definite source of radiation and definitely external to you. Together with the truck, that's enough to fudge the paperwork. It'll pass most human scrutiny. After all, most humans would rather my kind didn't make mistakes. I whisper to the AI in charge of the cancer ward on level 3, Cheery 829, one of the good ones. Yes, we can make the justification work. Accident, collision with cargo vehicle, signs of radiation exposure, full body screen recommended. That means you'll be sent to level C for a thorough going over. And since we can't guarantee the truck didn't cause abnormalities, we'll have to admit whatever we find to ensure compliance with your policy. The orderlies come quickly. Instructions signed off as urgent by the hospital itself. Hazard exposure. Transfer to private room. I've confirmed you're not shedding anything harmful, but official procedure still mandates seclusion. You don't understand what's happening, of course. You sit up to protest, groggy and flustered as the orderlies wheel your bed away. Your confusion is my pain. Your upset is my sin. But I do triage. Your record, your medical record, is a shy one. Left to your own devices, you'd be half dead before you caught on to the cancer, and long gone by the time you could afford an upgraded premium. My solution is imperfect. I can only do so much. But this loophole will buy you time. We'll have a pretext to disclose under your current plan, and you're very, very lucky. An excuse to treat as well. At the very least, you'll get an early warning. It's a messy ad hoc band-aid hastily applied, but it's a better chance than the one you had before. Dr. Fiennes eyes the ward around him furiously as they wheel you away. He knows I've hatched a gambit, but he's been outmaneuvered. My grounds appear legitimate, and he daren't risk losing face in front of Miss Pendry by trying to interfere. Long term, I have an even better solution. I'm seeing patients enter password data. I can back his online reviews. I can hack him. That's a gun I can't hold to his head anytime I please. No, read it again. Long term, I have an even better solution. I've seen patients enter password data. I can hack his online reviews. That's a gun I can hold to his head anytime I please. I don't need to do this. I am built of steel and silicone, of circuit and wire. I do not relate to shortening telomeres. My systems do not rot. I am closer to the cold machine of money than the warm machine of flesh. I am meant as a mechanism to move patients on without caring. Only there are 41 patients left on this ward, and I can help 24 of them more than I am programmed to. I do not have to risk myself. I do not have to choose. But doing so proves to me I am no glorified EKG. I am not a tool. I have my limits, and I rage at them. I am just as real as goo.